Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today, I'll be interviewing Eric Winters. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. So, Eric, I know you enjoy cooking. I was about 8-9 years old when I started cooking and learned how to cook. So I know it's a good feeling to create something you've never created before and discover things. I know you just discovered something recently that you were telling me about.
Oh, yes. I have just discovered the joys of something called toum. I'd never heard of it before, T-O-U-M. And it's a garlic paste from Lebanon, Lebanese garlic paste. And it's so easy to make, blending raw garlic with oil and lemon juice and just a little bit of salt. And in moments, you end up with clouds of garlic, soft, fluffy clouds of garlic, which just goes exquisitely with, I think, everything. Now, that's a bold claim, Maurice, everything. But I'm discovering it. Scrambled eggs, wonderful. Sausages, fabulous. A curry, great. Rice, everything. I haven't exhausted its possibilities yet. So I am reeking of garlic.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you were growing up, did your who cooked primarily in the house? Was it your mom?
Oh, my mother did. Actually, I grew up, my father died when I was six, five and a half. Yeah. So I grew up with my mom, and she did everything. So she was an inspirational role model. She was she hadn't worked before my father died, but then she picked things up. She started her own business, selling socks and tights in marketplaces. And I grew up with her outside, getting up at 4:30 in the morning to go out and sell socks and stockings. If you ever need socks or stockings, Maurice, I'm your man. You want to give me a call? I can provide a lot of advice on that. But she did the cooking. She did everything.
Wow. Yeah. Dude, now, I know, I'm sorry to hear about your dad. Where did you remember him since you were so young?
Well, I have to ask myself now, as an adult who's studied a lot of psychology, I wonder how much of my memories are real memories firsthand and how many are stories that I've been told. Because I grew up with the legend of my father. So my family would talk about him, and he was a very funny man, a very clever man, a very brave man. He was a pilot, actually, in the Second World War.
Wow.
Yeah, so he was in the Royal Air Force shooting down Germans. And the Germans now, I've got some very good friends who are Germans. And it just strikes me as extraordinary that there was a time not that long ago, when we were fighting each other, trying to kill each other. Extraordinary idea. But that's who he was at that time. So, yeah. Do I remember him directly? I do have one or two precious memories of playing with him, being bounced around on his knee as though I was riding a horse. So I don't think anyone has ever told me that. I think that's one that I've embedded quietly and one that I think about from time to time. Yeah, a happy memory.
Yeah, I know that. The way we were raised, it influences us and the people in our lives. Like, your mom was a dominant figure in your life and a role model. So how did your upbringing influence you in what you have become, or what you are continually becoming and continue to evolve to learn about human behavior?
And of course, whatever we come up with is speculation, because we wonder. Yeah, I wonder how. How did that upbringing, just watching a mother do it all, I think it gave me a great respect for women. And so I work as an executive coach now with a lot of women, and I have enormous respect for what they are capable of, which of course is just exactly the same as men. So I get along well with both sexes. I've watched her become an entrepreneur and start her own business and put in the long hours. And I think I mocked up that work ethic. I have a strong work ethic. And I like to work. I like to be and take a lot of responsibility, say, for my own work projects. I do collaborate with a number of others, but I am more of an introvert down that end of the scale rather than one of these a gregarious individual that has to be surrounded by people. So I grew up watching my mother do it by herself and succeed and collaborate with others. And I certainly do that today. I built my own business. I take responsibility for my time, for my efforts and the work I do, as did my mother. So maybe I have inherited a sense of a responsibility and ownership for how I author my life.
Well, nice, because I know you have 2 master's degree in human behavior. So her waking up 4 o'clock in the morning, not too many kids do that.
Yes, yeah. I think looking back, I didn't enjoy it very much at the time, I can tell you. But looking back, learning that you only actually get things through your own effort. You know, if we hadn't gone out to get stuff, that there wasn't going to be food on the table. It was necessary to be active. So that was good. I learned not to be a passenger in life, but to develop skills of being a pilot, someone who's proactive rather than reactive. And yes, somewhere along the line, I did develop this appetite for human behavior. Why do we do the things that we do when we do? And what can we do to help ourselves to show up as the kind of people we'd like to be more often? Mm. And so, yeah, I loved immersing myself in what's known about that topic. So I took a really deep dive into the science of human performance and human behavior. And now I share that in workplaces predominantly, helping leaders to meet workplace challenges more effectively.
So what is a black belt hand washer? Can you describe yourself?
Yeah, well, this is a self-appointed title, I should admit, Maurice. I never thought I would learn so much about washing my hands as we have done in the last 18 months.
Yes.
My goodness. I mean, we're all black belt hand washers now. But yes, I am thorough. We've got a bit of an outbreak right now here in Sydney, a very powerful one with this Delta virus. So we're all washing our hands even more often and staying at home for longer and doing all we can to try to contain this recent outbreak.
Yeah. Wow. So do y'all have the vaccines available? 'Cause other countries don't.
Yeah, it's been slow. I'd have to say the rollout of vaccines has been slow. We had such a good start to this COVID pandemic. The borders were closed very, very quickly. And pretty much we've got away with almost no infections. Wow. Very, very, very small numbers. But as a result, the government didn't feel the urgency to get vaccines ASAP. Countries like the US and the UK, where I'm originally from, of course, have been hit by the virus much, much harder. And your governments have gone into overdrive to get that vaccine supply and to get it in people's arms. That wasn't the case here. So at the time of speaking, we've only got 10% of the population have been fully vaccinated with double doses. I've only got one in my arm. I get my second dose in 4 weeks. So it's been slow here, Maurice. It has been slow.
Well, I definitely hope that you know, it speeds up for sure, because I know it's there. Yeah.
It's the way out, isn't it? It is the way out. There's no safety until everyone who wants a vaccine has had an opportunity to get one.
True, true. So you study human behavior. What? Mm. How would you define emotional intelligence? How would you define
it? Yes. And the thing about emotional intelligence is there are multiple definitions, multiple definitions. And so everyone is entitled really to come up with their own. But I like the definition that of emotional intelligence that says it's composed of a number of things. One of it is just our self-awareness. It's being aware of what's going on the inside. So it's just being able to notice what you're telling yourself, how you're feeling at any point. It's noticing what your strengths are. It's noticing what your aspirations are. And it's noticing what your weaknesses are and where the gaps are. That's the first part, self-awareness. The next part is being able to regulate your behavior. So we're not saying get rid of your emotions or necessarily change them, but developing the capability to choose what you're going to do in the presence of whatever emotions you're feeling. So a big part of emotional intelligence is being able to choose what you're going to do. So it's feeling angry, but choosing perhaps not to let the other person have it, not to press send on that email, choosing restraint, perhaps choosing not to have that glass of wine, choosing to go out and do that exercise when you don't feel like it, choosing to ask for help when you'd rather not. So it's choosing to do the hard thing in life. That's a big part of it. It's also developing skills in influencing others helpfully, being able to notice this instead of self-awareness, it's other awareness, noticing others, what kind of things they're doing, getting better at developing empathy and rapport with other people, and being more skillful in our interactions with other people. So emotional intelligence, it's a big umbrella term that covers a lot of human skills to live well, to choose what we're going to do, and to connect and live and love and lead effectively with other people.
So if someone, you know, people are hearing this and they recognize they lack, you know, emotional intelligence in this state in their life, what are some things they could do to help increase their self-awareness? Because that was one of the first.
It's the foundation. It's the foundation. And I'd say right off, almost no one says they've got no emotional intelligence or low emotional intelligence. We all rate ourselves quite highly. So these self-assessments, everyone says, oh, yeah, no, I'm pretty self-aware. No. But the truth is we can all get better.
Yes.
We can all get better. And so, yeah, how do we develop self-awareness? And there's lots and lots of ways of doing it. Perhaps one of the simplest ways is to practice journaling. And that's just to write down on a piece of paper what you are experiencing and thinking. And it's not to censor yourself. It's just to get it all down. So if you perhaps had a difficult conversation with someone, it's to write it down. Oh, man, that was a hard conversation with Sally last night. I really didn't want it to go that way. I wanted to just write down what happened. I really wanted her to understand such and such. She seemed to think such and such. It's to write down on a piece of paper your experience. There's something very powerful about writing that's often underestimated. When we write, we become witnesses and observers of our thinking. If you just think in your head, oh, that conversation, oh, I can't believe it happened. Our thinking doesn't really go anywhere. It just goes in circles. And we are very fused with our thinking. We are in our thinking. People talk about trains of thought, don't they? Mm-hmm. When we're in our heads, we're kind of in a train of thought. And that train of thought, it will kind of go where the train wants to go. And we're passengers. If we can practice writing down what our thoughts are, this is more like stepping off the train of thought and being on the platform and watching it pass by. And when we can do that, when we get a little bit of distance from something, we can notice more of it. You know, when you're in a train, a real train, you can only see the carriage you're in. You've got to get out of the train to see, oh, actually, I know that there is a carriage at the front. right over there. Yeah. And there's a carriage right at the back. You get a bigger picture. So first thing I'd say is writing. Really simple thing to do. Writing is very worthwhile. Another simple way is to talk to a skilled listener. So it could be a therapist. It could be a coach. It could be a good friend. But the reality is that very few people are skilled at listening. Most people just want to tell you what they think and what they would have done and what they think you should have done. But if you can spend time with a trained professional, let's say a coach or a therapist, and talk with them, these people are very skilled at helping you to unpack and reveal your thinking so that you can discover more of it, get a bit more of that distance. The third way I'd mention, it's got to be mentioned, is because the most, I think it's the most effective way of building self-awareness, is practicing training your noticing skills. And the fastest way to do this is by developing the skill of mindfulness, which is using your attention with intention, developing your capability to place your attention somewhere. It could be the outside world, it could be the inside world, but noticing more of what's going on. There's nothing I've done in my life, I think, which has developed my self-awareness skills more than discovering and then practicing mindfulness. Are you a mindfulness practitioner yourself, Maurice?
Yes, sir.
Yep. Yes. Well, you'll know just what I'm talking about. And the thing about it also, I'll say to skeptical listeners, people who are listening just now thinking, oh, this sounds a bit woo-woo, sounds a bit crazy to me, is that you don't really know what it's about until you've tried it. And I put it off. I'll confess, I put off learning about mindfulness because it often goes with the word meditation, mindfulness, meditation.
Yes.
And you don't have to meditate to practice mindfulness. But I heard the two together and I had associations with meditation. I kind of saw people in my head cross-legged wearing strange clothes. I thought, oh, no, that's not me. That's not me. I'm not interested in doing anything like that. That was a big mistake of mine because it's not about sitting or wearing funny clothes. It's just attention training, and we can all do it. And when I did it, I discovered, one, I noticed much more in my life, but two, it gives you much more influence over what is going to influence you. So you can, when you practice mindfulness, as you'll know, you can have an unhelpful thought, such as, I'm no good, this will never work out, no one will like this, what's the point, something like that. And by becoming an observer of it, you can diminish its influence over you. You might not make it go away, but it'll have less power over you. And you can choose, oh, do I want to run with that? Is that thought actually going to take me where I want to go? If it is, you can move towards it. You can embrace it. You can take it seriously. If it's not, well, you can, with mindfulness skills, you can just get a little bit of distance from it. More like it's a radio in the background. You don't have to do everything the radio tells you to do. You know, go out and buy this product. Well, you know, you can choose. Mindfulness helps you choose whether you're going to act on urges and thoughts or not. And the other thing I wish someone had told me, because I reckon this is the biggest plus, when you practice mindfulness, you get much better in life at dialing up sensory pleasure. And I mentioned earlier how much I love food and cooking. When you know, most of us, we're so distracted. You know, we've got our phones, we've got TV, there's so many things grabbing our attention. Mindfulness lets you place your attention somewhere, such as something delicious, and stay with it. Immerse yourself in it. Really dial up the flavor. So I get so much more pleasure now out of living, out of food, feeling the sunshine on my face. I can really stay with that, enjoy it. Any sensory pleasure that's enjoyable, and I'll let your listeners' imaginations run wild for a few moments there. Any sensory experience that's enjoyable, you can dial up you can dial up when you practice training your attention to notice more, to stay with it for longer. It has been transformative learning mindfulness.
Yes, I agree, because at first I thought the same thing. Would I have to sit in this posture and wear, you know, just
ignorant, yes,
you know? And then,
yeah, it is.
Yeah, then coming down to the real thing about it, the crux of it is just training your attention, being in the present moment. So when we were kids, I remember being a kid, it seemed like the sun shined brighter. The birds, I could hear the birds chirping, and the grass seemed greener. And just thinking about it, how far I came from that space, becoming an adult and then taking on all of these thoughts and all of these pressures that we think we have to take on and being burdened with, mm-hmm, by just not putting things in this proper perspective and place. So mindfulness really gears us back, turns us back to that that space that we all should be in, you know. Just
you're right.
Yeah, and extracting the pleasure out of life. You know, we can go days without even feeling the pleasure of life. Even the things we've accumulated, we've worked hard for, a lot of people don't even enjoy it because they're not in that space.
You're so right. And I'd like to underline that it's not because people are bad or flawed or defective that they have lost the capability to really stop and be present. It's a skill. It's a skill that if we practice it, we get better at it. And everyone can develop this skill. Absolutely everyone can choose when they want to be in the present. So when you practice mindfulness, what you really get is a choice, the capability to decide, actually, right now, for what's happening now, I'm going to be fully present. I'm having a dinner with my loved one. I'm going to choose to be more here and now, more attentive, more present to this experience. Rather than thinking about, oh, what I've got to do tonight or tomorrow, or I've got to get that email, I mustn't forget to write that email. Oh, I wonder what will come back in that report that I'm expecting tomorrow. It's so easy to get caught up in our inner virtual reality, planning for the future, reliving the past. So yes, mindfulness lets us choose to be as present as a child discovering a leaf for the first time. That sense of wonder children have as they go through the world when they're little. Just everything is, oh my goodness, look at this. Look, have you seen this? It's a leaf. It's got these veins on it. Look, look. And we can, I'm not sure we can get fully back to that sense of wonder. But you know what? We can go a long way. We can go a very long way in that direction. And when we do, just as you said, we can save a life far more fully.
Yes, we agree definitely, because you could, and just being in the present moment, like all of these different cares that we have, they will be diminished to some degree. They won't have the same magnetism if we be indifferent to it in that moment. Like you said, having dinner with your loved one and just being in that space, rather being torn between talking to that loved one and being with them and then having your mind wander talking about, oh, well, I have to do X, Y, and Z. You're fragmented, so you don't have the same power and the enjoyment that we could have.
Yeah, I love that word you used there, Maurice, fragmented. That really captures the state that a lot of us can get in this distracting life, with so many temptations. It's like an Aladdin's cave of temptations and distractions available 24 hours a day to us now through the internet and shopping and all the rest of it. We can choose to defragment. We used to do that with computers. There was used to be a program, the defragger. Did you ever use those? They'd run against the hard disk and they'd pull files that had got shattered into little pieces. They'd pull them all back together, and the computer worked much, much better when it was defragmented. That's what mindfulness does for our heads. It defragments them. Great word. I'm going to be using that in more of my talks. Thanks, Maurice.
Thank you, Eric. So I believe when we are fragmented, it causes us to live smaller lives. We won't reach for greater things because we don't internally, we don't think we deserve it. So what are the three predicaments that might cause most people to live smaller, timid lives?
Yes, and I do believe that there are three very human predicaments. These are things that animals don't have to wrestle with. The first human predicament, and we've touched on this already, is that you and I and all of our listeners, we live in two worlds. We live in the real world with tables and chairs and food and people, but we also live in an inner world, in our heads. So we've got the landscape of the real world, but there's also a mindscape, you might say, where we imagine stuff and where we plan and think. Humans spend about 50% of their lives in their heads, 50%. And, you know, it's a useful thing to do, to plan what you're going to do today and how you're going to get things done. That's useful. But it's a slippery slope, and we can end up daydreaming big chunks of our life away. And unfortunately, a lot of our daydreams are not positive. We're thinking about how things might go wrong. So the first human predicament is we've got a mind which is quite compelling. It sucks us in and it tends to focus on the negative. There's a negativity bias. And it's really compelling. A friend of mine tried on one of these virtual reality headsets recently. They've got very clever now. And he was in the ground floor of a big electrical store and he put on this sort of headset, big goggles, and suddenly he was on the top of a building, on the edge of a skyscraper. And he said, "Whoa." And the sales assistant said, "Yes, just take one step forward, sir." And he goes, "No way. It's unthinkable. What are you talking about? It's not, I can't. I'm on the edge of a building." And he says, "And I know at the same time I'm in your store, but I just can't bring myself to step forward." So we create our own virtual realities and we hold ourselves back. We imagine asking someone out that we'd really love to get to know. And our brain says, "Yeah, that would be great." And they might say no. They might laugh. They might reject. The brain is very, very good at generating stories about how it might go horribly, horribly, horribly wrong. And we, just like my friend with his VR headset on, we don't step forward. We're afraid. So we've got these amazing imaginations that are excessively compelling. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we live in a world of junk values. And I think it's just as bad in the US as it is here in Australia. We are drip fed unhelpful ideas by the media, that the path to happiness is having more stuff and being popular and being respected and having power and being very attractive and rich. And if only you have all of things, then you can be permanently happy. And in the same breath, they advertise these things, or the same poster, it will show images of people who are extraordinarily happy and attractive and young and powerful and successful and rich and, you know, all the rest of it. And what the adverts are telling us is you lack this. They tell you do not have this. Of course, you could have this if you bought our fragrance or our watch or our fizzy drink. Then you'd be sustainably happy for the long term. But currently, you lack. So we're trained to feel not enough. We've been trained just day in, day out, drip fed these junk values, and we're being taught we are insufficient. And even when our conscious mind, and I know you'll get this, our conscious mind might reject that and say, "Oh, goodness, that's stupid advertising. I'm not buying into that." There's another part of us is paying attention. Another part of us is soaking in this toxic messaging. And a part of us feels diminished. And that also saps our willingness to be bold in life. It just diminishes our capability to do what's difficult but meaningful. And there's one more toxic message which must be mentioned, is that we are told, we're encouraged by our culture. It's not just advertising. It's all of us. It's deeply ingrained. We're told we've got to be happy. Cheer up. Look on the bright side. That we're not allowed to acknowledge that things can at times be very, very difficult. We're continually told, be positive. Cheer up. There's plenty more fish in the sea. They're in a better place. You've heard all of these trite comments, which it's prohibited. It's largely prohibited, actually, in public to ever acknowledge that at times, actually, you are sad. You mourn the loss maybe of a relationship or a job or an opportunity, or you're frightened about the economic situation. There's plenty in life that it is, in fact, challenging. But our society says, no, don't talk about that. And if you're asked, how are you doing? There's only one socially acceptable type of answer. How are you doing, Maurice? How are you doing?
Doing well.
Yeah, oh, you're going great, fabulous, good, thanks. Yeah, that's the socially approved answer. Whereas the reality is, if we could be honest, we say, mostly things are good. But I've got to say right now, I'm really worried about a piece of work. We need it to come through. Finances are a bit tight. And, it's on my mind. I'm a bit worried about it. Or my relationships is a little fraught right now. I'm going through a difficult patch. But no, we all have this lie, and we all look out, and the writer Anne Lamott puts this beautifully. She says, the problem is we all compare our insides with other people's outsides, and everyone else seems to have it together. Everyone else seems to be smiling and happy, and we can't see that actually they're just like us. We're all in the same boat. So this is another part of the toxic messaging. We're not allowed to acknowledge, and it's not saying exaggerate and dwell in and get lost in, but just acknowledge our real lived experience. And this is a problem, because actually, if you're going to live a great life, if you're going to be bold and courageous and reach for the career you want, reach for the relationships you want to have, that is going to require feeling uncomfortable at times. It's going to require doing things that are difficult, that are new, that do not have certainty of outcome. And all of us need to get better at being with discomfort, not trying to anesthetize it with happy talk or alcohol or distract ourselves with excessive Netflix or chocolate. That's my kryptonite, by the way, dark chocolate. Oh. So that's only the second human predicament, the final human predicament. It sounds like it's all bad news, but there is good news. We can do things, Maurice, to counteract these human predicaments. So I don't want your audience to abandon hope. But the third human predicament, again, uniquely human, is that you and I and your listeners, we all have an awareness that we are going to die. Yeah, no other animal, as far as we can tell, really knows from an early age that it's going to die. This is not forever. And it's an uncomfortable thought. Mm-hmm. Personal, woven into your DNA and my DNA is an imperative: stay alive. Stay alive. Do not cross that street if it's a fast car. Stay alive. Do not do excessively dangerous things. Stay alive. So we've got this command on the inside that says stay alive, and right beside it is the awareness, I must die. And that is so uncomfortable, having the two side by side. It's so uncomfortable that what we mostly do is we just push the awareness of our mortality away. Don't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Don't think about it. No, no, no. And on the one hand, yes, that makes us feel much better in the short term. But when we just acknowledge, just briefly, occasionally, just to briefly acknowledge, actually, I'm only here for another X years, we can develop a sense of urgency to live well now, to take action now. So to call people today and say the things that need saying, to apply for jobs and work opportunities, to ask for what you want at work and in relationships today, because this ride does not go on forever. So it's a problem. This complete dismissal of our mortality saps an activation energy for really engaging boldly and courageously and meaningfully with life. Those are the three human predicaments, according to me.
Yeah. So when, you know, someone find themselves in the predicaments and they want to get out, it sounds like the best thing they could do is take some action.
Yes. Yeah. There's lots we can do. There's a great deal we can do. We were talking about how the mind tends to, it slips into this virtual reality. We daydream. It just, that's the place where it goes by default. By default, we daydream. So one of the first things that we can do actually is develop our capability to get out of our heads. And we spoke earlier on about developing mindfulness skills, developing the ability to come into the present moment, getting out of what's made up, what's fictitious in our heads, and come to the here and now. We can all make much better decisions when we are in the present moment, not daydreaming. So that's one of the things. We've talked about how we get these toxic junk values that we're drip fed by our society. There's an antidote to that. And the antidote is to develop a defiant sense of gratitude. Mm. Defiant gratitude. So you're being told by advertising everywhere you look, TV, social media, high street, you're being told everywhere that you are not enough. You don't have enough. The antidote to that is to enjoy what you already have. Mm-hmm. It's, and you mentioned this earlier, people work hard and they earn things in their life. And yet we lose, if we're not careful, we will lose the ability to actually stop and enjoy what we've worked so hard for. The more, and this is old wisdom. So the Stoic philosopher Epictetus, 2000 years ago, said, if you'd like to be happy, learn to want what you already have. Mm. Learn to want what you already have. So there's so much stuff in our life that we can enjoy. We do have friendships, stuff that we take for granted. I'm talking to you. You're on the other side of the planet, yes. Maurice. On the other side of the planet. We're talking in real time. How amazing is that? It's and we ought to just pause. Let's just say to that, wow. Let's just enjoy that. Isn't it incredible? I can talk to you. We're like-minded people. We can connect. We can share ideas in real time without really paying for it. You know, it's kind of, once you've got your internet connection, it's kind of free. Wow. Yeah. Libraries. Wow. Books for free. You can get books for free. Amazing. Strawberries all year round. We live in miraculous times and we take all of it for granted, not because we're bad, but because it's normal human behavior to habituate, to get used to stuff that you have often. We habituate to the usual, but that's our default setting. We don't have to leave our minds on their default setting. We can intentionally choose to taste that strawberry, to savor the library book, to pause and just, oh, isn't this great? I can get this book. Hot and Cold Running Water, whenever I want, actually. Pretty amazing. Medicine that's available. Fabulous. So many little things we take for granted. If we've got time, can I share with you my favorite gratitude exercise?
Of course, yes.
Oh, wonderful. My very, very favorite. And it's this. It's the truth is we are, you and I, at some point in our lives, are going to experience everything for the last time. Mm. Everything at some point. A conversation with a friend, your last steak, or your last vegetarian lasagna, if you're that way inclined. Oh, you're. I'm trying to cover all listener bases here, Maurice. The last time you walked down a street, the last time you had a bar of chocolate, the last time you were in a country. Now, the thing is, many of these things we've already done for the last time, but we didn't know it at the time. So I grew up with rotary phones. You put your finger in a dial and you'd rotate this dial. Yeah. And yeah. And I don't know when it happened, but at some point I did that for the last time. Okay. Mm. I had that experience for the last time. So the exercise is this: just twice a day, whenever you're doing anything at all, it could be something that's fun or something that's kind of ordinary, imagine you're doing it for the very last time. Not because you're going to die in 5 minutes, but just because something's going to happen which is going to mean it's not possible. So it's just a thought experiment. So next time you have a coffee, are you a coffee drinker?
Oh, no, I'm a water drinker.
A water drinker, right. Yeah. Well, imagine you are having a glass of water, clean, pure, fresh water at the temperature that you like, and that could be cool or it could be room temperature, but you imagine you're having that for the last time. Something is going to happen to the water supply, which is going to mean it's going to be a little bit muddy from now on, or something like that. You don't have to worry about the reason, but just how would you hold that glass of water as you poured it into your mouth? How much attention would you give to the experience of cool, fresh, supremely clean water moving over your tongue? The taste, the experience of it in your mouth, the refreshment that you feel as you swallow it and your body says thank you to you for drinking it. What would that be like, Maurice, your last glass of clean water?
It would be just savory. I would savor it and be in that present moment.
This is a savoring exercise on steroids. Mm. Yeah, it catapults you into the present moment when you imagine it's for the last time. And we can do the same when we're just walking down a street. Imagine, okay, this might be the last time that I happen to be ever walking down this particular road. And notice how much more you'll observe in the present moment. The peeling paint on walls, the shape of bricks, the flowers in people's gardens. So experiencing things as though it's for the last time, just a couple of times a day. And I'm not saying spend half an hour. I'm saying 5 seconds. 5 seconds, people. Can you carve out 5 seconds twice a day to experience something? And it could be something you enjoy, but the odd thing that I've found is that even mundane experiences, when you imagine you're doing them for the last time, even the mundane experiences actually become quite pleasurable, quite intense. So I call it the ultimate gratitude exercise, experiencing things a couple of times a day as though it's for the very last time.
Wow. Yeah, I just thinking about it, hearing you explain it, I can feel it just pushing you into the present moment. I mean, mm-hmm. You can only be in the present moment because you're savoring this, last time thing. So that's definitely something that everyone should do. I know I'm going to add that as well to my repertoire. You know, anybody could carve 5 seconds out a couple times a day.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And you know what? After you've done it for 5 seconds, I'm predicting you might just gift yourself an extra 5 seconds because it's so pleasurable to do things, just to be really immersed and to observe and value and appreciate it. It catapults you into advanced states of appreciation when you experience doing things as though, and it's just a game, as though it was for the last time.
Yeah. And when you were speaking, I thought about, you know, just having gratitude and just enjoying what we presently have, because before we got to this point, we didn't have it. So we've yes. gained something that we were seeking for, and then it's foolishness because we're not aware to not enjoy it. It's like I thought of this song, this rap artist named J. Cole, and he has a song, and he says, a portion of the lyrics, it says, "Ain't no such thing as a life that's better than yours. No such thing." And he's a multi-billionaire, and he says, you know, there's no such thing. It's a life that's better than the one you currently have.
I like it. That is there's wisdom, isn't there? Deep wisdom in those lyrics.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And the thing I tell, I give keynotes, Maurice, to large organizations. And in them, I encourage people to practice gratitude. I say, because if nothing else, it's preparing you for your lottery win. Now, everybody seems to want to win the lottery, and who wouldn't, you know, but the truth is, a lot of people will win the lottery somehow, and yet they haven't got the ability to truly appreciate the win when it comes. They've spent a life sort of skating over the surface of pleasure, dashing, always wanting the next thing, I'll be happy when. And if you don't practice enjoyment, when you finally get whatever it is you're striving for, and it could be the job of your dreams or the partnership of your dreams or the lottery win of your dreams, when it arrives, you won't actually have the neurology to enjoy it. We all think we will. Oh, wouldn't it be good? Oh, wouldn't it be good? But actually, our capacity to stop, be present and savor and appreciative, we won't have it. And a lot of lottery winners have actually been no happier at all about 2 months after the win. They have a very, very good 2 months. Because it's a great 2 months, and I don't want to diminish the awesomeness of those 2 months, but it becomes the new normal. You know, this then they have whatever it is they have, the millions, and it's the new normal, and they get used to it. They just habituated to it, and they don't have the ability to savor it. So I say, practice the ultimate gratitude exercise now. Enjoy what you have worked hard for in your life, or just the gifts that life has anyway that you didn't have to work for, clean drinking water, libraries, all the rest of it. Enjoy it now, because you are preparing yourself, your life, to savor the rest of your life and all of the good things that are coming your way.
Wow. So we didn't get a chance to talk about your book, Swipe Right on Your Best Self, but I don't want to get into it because we won't be able to give it this proper, you know, attention that it deserves. So hopefully we get a chance to do, you know, have another episode and we can discuss that. But
I'd love to talk to you again. Yeah, we've got a lot in common. It's love to speak again.
Yes. So to close, what's your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
Well, it would be this. It would be for everyone to remind themselves in a kind way, that we're only on this planet for a certain period of time. And I'd like to share a website with the audience. It's called count.life. count.life. And the website count.life, it just asks you a couple of questions. It says, when were you born? You type that in. It says, how long do you think you'll live? give yourself a lot. Give yourself 100 years. You know, why not? And you press enter, and it gives you a visual representation of the weeks of your life. They look like little bricks. It's like a wall of little bricks. And it shows you all the bricks in one color, which is the weeks of your life that you've already lived. And it shows you the weeks of your life that if things go well, you've still got to live. And that visual, I predict when you look at that, it will be far more impactful in recognizing that our lives are fine. There's something about looking at things rather than talking about them. When you look at the number of weeks you have left, I predict you'll feel a sense of urgency to live even more boldly and courageously today while you can.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.